My first Zen teacher simplistically somewhat said that Buddhism is about sitting in meditation. And Gandhi's contribution to Buddhism is that it matters where you sit. And the implication being that for political action, for social justice, for all kinds, you know, that it depends where you sit. You know, if you sit certain places, maybe it doesn't have any impact, but if you sit on the train tracks or if you sit different locations, you know, it, like people did in Lawrence Livermore Labs, it has a very different impact. So where you sit is important. So the San Francisco Zen Center, where I practiced in my early years, was in the kind of the Haight Fillmore area in San Francisco. And it was a fairly dangerous neighborhood to live in. And there were housing projects nearby, a lot of drug dealing and prostitution, a lot of shooting and stabbing and mugging and cars being broken into and fires. And it was an exciting neighborhood to be in. And that's where we sat. And we had this meditation hall that was on the corner of the building, and in one corner of the building was the alley where you didn't want to go when it was dark, and then Laguna Street on the other side. And it was quite something to sit in that zendo, because in some of the hot days, especially the windows were open, or even if the windows were closed, you could hear what was going on the other side of the wall, in the alley. And, you know, we'd hear people being mugged, or we'd hear glasses being broken, and we hear, you know, the fire trucks would come up, or the police would have their action, or there'd be, you know, and in many of the situations, the practice was to sit in the middle of it. It was very important. The idea was you sat not where the action was, but you sat in the midst of the world. You didn't remove yourself off in some quiet, you know, isolated place for your own private meditation, but your meditation practice existed in the middle of life as it really is. And there it was. Now, we didn't just sit there peacefully when people were being mugged. Though if someone was, you know, what's that expression? If the prostitute was doing her trick on the other side of the wall, then we just sat. But so if somebody was calling for help, it was obvious someone was in distress, then it was quite impressive to see all these Zen students, you know, sitting quietly in meditation. Just the first instant of it was clear that someone needed help, they would leap off their cushions and, you know, in Zen style and dash out the doors and to see if they could help. And I remember once, I was a Zen priest there, a shaved head and wore black robes. And there was one of these incidences, and everybody's running out. And there were, I don't know, 20, 30 people running down Page Street because a woman had her purse stolen. And the mugger went that way. She was there kind of yelling for help, and so he went down there. So 20, 30 people went down, and for some reason I was kind of in the back of the crowd, and I figured, you know, there was too many people running. You know, it didn't really make sense for me to run also, so I stayed behind with one or two other people and kind of started walking down the street slowly, and kind of just happened to go up against this kind of area where the Zen hospice is. And this guy jumps out of the bushes, and he goes up against the wall and says something like, holding the purse. And said something like, you know, he was obviously very afraid of me because I don't think of myself as an intimidating person. But for all he could, you know, with a shaved head and black robes, I looked like Kung Fu. So I had him cornered. So he started walking kind of like this, kind of along the side of the garage, side of the building. And there was a small crowd of us, you know, had a half circle around him until he came to the corner of the building. And then, of course, there was no half circle anymore, right? There was a part of the circle was missing, so he dashed off, leaving the purse behind. So the ringing reminded me that of all that. And and in some ways, I like this neighborhood a lot because it's a neighborhood where there's a certain amount of action and activity, and you really feel like you're part of an urban environment, and the spiritual practice happens in the midst of it. And I would imagine some of you would think, well, it'd be better if we could be off someplace very quiet and serene. And you know, some place was obviously meditative, as if some place serene was more meditative. But I like it. I think it's appropriate. I think it's healthy for us to kind of be in the midst of the city as it is. And those of you who've come here Thursday and Friday morning know that it's also very exciting here. Or you should come sometime if you haven't, if you don't mind being disturbed. Thursday, Friday mornings between about 9 and 11 or so. There's anti-abortion protests on the street here because of Planned Parenthood across the street. And I've been perplexed about how to respond to the anti-abortion protests. I'm still kind of considering it. But I feel like one of the things we bring to this conflict between Planned Parenthood and the anti-abortion protesters is we kind of bring our presence. Like we're here, this is where we are. I feel like we're in the middle of them, and we sit kind of in a meditative way. And in meditation, in a way, you don't take sides. What you do is you bring presence, with some trust that presence will make a big difference in the situation. When I was at San Francisco Zen Center, there were all these... the Zen Center was very much involved in the local neighborhood, helping people. And there were these landlords of apartment buildings that were taking advantage of their tenants, had very shoddy, kind of dangerous buildings. And so Zen Center was helping these tenants in various ways. But Zen Center very clearly didn't want to do anything that was political, that was actually in opposition or alienated the landlords. Because it felt as a Zen temple, it should, as a meditation center, it should be a place where anybody felt welcome to come into the doors to meditate. And if they got involved in the politics, then the landlords wouldn't want to come. And they probably needed more than anybody in the neighborhood. So we sit here with our doors open and meditate. This leads up to the announcement, my announcement, and that is that September 11th, we're going to have a meeting here Wednesday evening, and that'll be 7:30 to 9, and it's a sitting and a reflection on September 11th. I'm not sure what we do, as I wasn't sure what we would do last year when we had our meetings right after September 11th. I still don't know what we'll do when we gather on September 11th, but it felt to me like for some of us it would be very important and poignant to at least sit together that evening and then have some way of reflecting on that event or ourselves in the midst of it all. So if you'd like to come, that's September 11th. So what's been on my mind to talk about for about a week or so is the Buddhist Eightfold Path. Partly I was thinking about it because I finished this retreat a week ago Sunday. And during the retreat, there were a lot of people who were relatively new to meditation. And some of them, for example, very interesting. They go into the retreat kind of very challenged and wondering why they're there. And somewhere near the halfway point of the retreat, they start asking questions like, this is really great, but how can I apply it in my daily life? How can I make this relevant in my life? How can I bring presence, mindfulness, compassion, this level of kind of presence to the rest of my life where life is so busy and we get entangled so easily? So at the end of the retreat, the three teachers teaching it, we gave a little teaching on the Eightfold Path. Now Buddhism, as you probably many of you probably know, a number of Asian cultures emphasize the importance of a path. In Japan, you have the thing called the Dao, a Do, which is the way, like Aikido or Judo, Cha Do, the way of tea. And a Do is and it comes from the Chinese, a Dao. Dao, it's kind of a path or a way that you enter into, and it's not just an ism, but it's a way of life. It's something you engage and put your whole body into. Excuse me if I go on another tangent. There's also the way of archery. And Koben Chino, the local Zen teacher who died a few weeks ago, had studied the way of archery. And he once went to Eslon to do a demonstration of this way. And he got himself dressed in the Zen archery robes and had his bow and arrow and there was a big crowd of people watching, and he was there on the big lawn in Eslon. If some of you have been there, you know, it's a big lawn kind of overlooking the cliffs of the Pacific. And he entered into kind of this meditative process of preparing his arrow and his bow and getting himself psyched and ready. It was a whole like ritual. I'd imagine people were watching it, kind of almost got concentrated just watching this process of this guy very meticulously and very centering himself and getting ready. And you know, it wasn't just a matter of putting the arrow in the bow and shooting it. It was like maybe half an hour process or maybe more. And finally, you know, he put the arrow in the bow very meditative, very carefully and with great concentration, great stillness, got ready to, to fire that bow and aim really carefully and just was there, just waited just for the right moment. And I imagine people were breathless, there present. And finally, at the right moment, he let go of the arrow. And it went right directly into the bullseye that he was aiming at, which was the Pacific Ocean. So in India, they have the idea of a way. Buddhism is the Pali word is magga, in Sanskrit it's marga. And in India, there was many ways, many paths. And it's useful to think of that when you think of the word, because you think of the word Buddhism as being an ism, a belief system, a philosophy perhaps. And it's better think of it as a way of life. It's a way of living. It's a way that you enter into. It's a path. And many people will sit, at the edge of the path, watching it, looking at it, looking down the road, saying, Leeds a great place. And then they read another map and say, it really does lead to a great place. This is inspiring. And then they go buy another map. And this is really great. This path goes to a really beautiful place. And then they buy another map. And some people have, lots and lots of these maps in their bookcases, but they never actually put their feet onto the path. And I think of a path as something that we enter into with our, ideally, if we follow it for the full way, with our whole life. And it's something we walk along. So walking implies we bring our body along. There's a commitment involved. There's a you kind of bring everything you have to the path, whatever the path is that you choose to follow. And you bring your heart, your heartfeltness, and you bring your emotional life. You bring your intelligence and your mind. You bring your body. You bring your community, in the sense that you include your relationship to other people as part of the path. And the path, the image I have of a path is a clearing in a forest. And a forest is kind of maybe way overgrown. And if you had to go through a forest and there's no path, you'd have to spend a long time finding your way, and you'd spend a long time clearing the way. You have to bring machete perhaps and cutting away the branches and stuff so you can make your way through. But if there's a path there for you, then it's made a lot easier. And you can follow that clearing and opening in the forest and make your way to your destination a lot easier. So the Buddha discovered a path, and it's one of these paths through the forest it makes it a lot easier to follow your way. Some people feel that they want to make their own way, their own path, which is a beautiful concept. I'm going to follow my own way. However, the danger of that, or the shortcoming of that sometimes, is that it's like reinventing the wheel. You have to kind of then find your own way through the forest, and it might take a long time for you to do what could have been a lot faster if you went on an established path. So the Buddha offered the Eightfold Path, what it's called, and I think of it sometimes as the Eightfold, the Buddha's eight-step program. And the first thing that you have to admit when you're into the is that, yes, in fact, you're attached. And then you can begin. And in the Buddhist analysis of human mind or human tendencies, we're all addicts. And so we all kind of need something like Attachment Anonymous, and which is what we offer here. And so he offered these eight different steps or links or aspects of the path. And my understanding of it is it offers an integrated whole. So we don't think of it just something intellectual. We don't think of it just something of the mind. We don't think of it just something of ethics only, or only about, or we don't think it only about meditation. Some people choose meditation as being what they focus on only. Sometimes people ethics, or some people understanding. But all those three have to be there together. And that's what the description of the Eightfold Path is, to tie those and include all those three aspects together as a whole. And so as you listen to these eight different steps, you might reflect on your life and what are the different elements of your life that you could, that this speaks to, that could be brought more fully into a path, into your path of liberation, of meditation practice, or whatever you do here. The first part of the Eightfold Path is right view. And view or is a little bit different than philosophy or belief. View is like a perspective, a right perspective for understanding the life, the spiritual life that you want to live. So what's the what is a useful perspective? There are many perspectives. And sometimes, or another word is a framework. What's a useful framework for understanding our life that makes things easier? And the framework that the Buddha offered was the Four Noble Truths. And in fact, the right view is knowing really well the Four Noble Truths. A child can understand the Four Noble Truths, but it takes, it says, someone who's fully enlightened to really realize them fully, to understand their full depth. And so the Eightfold Path is actually embedded in the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths are the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the Eightfold Path. Truth here I don't take to mean like a philosophical creed, but again, it's a helpful perspective for looking at our life. The analogy I've often used is if you go to a doctor and you have something really terrible that ails you, you really worry about it, and it seems like it's a pretty dire situation, and you need help, and the doctor, you know, asks you, you know, about your golf score, and you don't play golf, and you say, well, and then, oh, what sport do you play? And you say, well, I go bowling. And they say, well, oh, you know, what size bowling shoes do you wear, and how heavy a ball do you use, and what's been your, how, you know, how's your latest games been, and. And you know you only have 15 minutes there at Kaiser to get in and out because they have, you know, because that's what the rule is. And so you know, it's, you know, she's asking, the doctor's asking you and asking you and asking you about all these things. And after a while, you kind of butt in after 14 and a half seconds and say, you know, those questions don't interest me. What interests me is the fact that I have something wrong with me and I want you to know what's wrong so you can help me. So the Four Noble Truths are kind of that perspective on our lives. You don't want to spend a lot of time looking at things which are not important or not useful. You don't want to spend a lot of time looking at, you know, Buddhist philosophy and get a PhD in Buddhism, for example. you want to make it as simple and straightforward as possible. And the Buddha suggestion is you start where the suffering is and you address it. You are very honest about it. Not to be morbid or dire or heavy about it, but in fact, to study it, to learn from it, and learn how to become lighter. Learn how to let go of the attachments, the holding, the fears, the resistance, that get in the way of the heart shining, getting in the way of the heart being free. So So to be sensitive to our suffering, to be interested in it, to not deny it or push it away or ignore it or hide it, but actually be willing to sit in the middle of it. Just like we sit in the middle of our neighborhood, so we sit in the middle of our life as it actually is. The second noble truth is that there's a cause to our suffering, and then there's an analysis of looking at what is that cause. And in looking at the cause, learning how we can release that cause, let go of that cause, or be free of it. To use the medical analogy, the first noble truth is the illness. The second noble truth is the diagnosis, the cause of the illness. The third noble truth is the prognosis, or the possibility of a cure. And the fourth noble truth is the prescription. So we become our own doctors in a sense. The right view suggests we become our own doctors. Suffering, the cause of suffering and our attachments, happiness, and the conditions for happiness to arise. Another way of saying the Four Noble Truths. So the first part of the Eightfold Step is to study, learn, understand really well the Four Noble Truths, so it becomes a readily available perspective for understanding what's happening in the present moment for us. So we can get right to the heart of things. And when I first got introduced to Buddhism, I thought that the Four Noble Truths were child's play. I remember an old girlfriend, I went over to see her for dinner, and she asked me, you know, what is this Buddhism you're involved in? What does it really teach? And I explained to her, well, it teaches about the Four Noble Truths. And I left that dinner party, you know, this is a woman I wanted to impress. And I left the dinner part of the dinner, and how could I have been? You know, I've been involved with Buddhism for some years now, and how could I have said something so simplistic? You know, the Four Noble Truths. You know, Buddhism is this great world religion, must have much greater things to say than this simple thing. But I've gotten to appreciate this more and more with time. And what happens? A place where it becomes particularly useful, the Four Noble Truths, as a perspective, as a framework of our experience, is when the meditation gets very subtle, when meditation gets very, very deep and very concentrated, and the mind actually gets filled with bliss and happiness and well-being and very still and great peace, that's sometimes actually one of the most important times to really to look at our experience through the perspective of the Four Noble Truths. It's a time when we often are blinded by the rapture that might be there, for example, or the great peace or the great equanimity. And there might still be some very, very subtle attachment playing itself out. And if you've trained yourself to study your experience from the perspective of the Four Noble Truths, then you want to be, you're always looking a little bit, where is that? Little bit of straining or resistance or pushing or holding onto something, a little bit of self-identity that is tied up with this experience. So to continue to purify and refine that so the heart becomes freer and freer. The second of the Eightfold Path is right, usually translated as the right intention. Sometimes it's right thought. I think of it as right alignment. So the Four Noble Truth involves a perspective for studying our lives. The right intention involves the motivation that we want to live our life by. And motivation is very, very important. What is the underlying, the fundamental intention that you want your life to be about? When you get to the end of your life and your deathbed, and what do you want to remember when you look back? You want to remember the fact that I finally got my oil changed? You want to, I say that because I was struggling the last 3 weeks, you know, when am I going to get my oil changed? And I finally got it changed this last week. Is that what you want your life to be about? And, you know, all kinds of things that we can get caught up in our daily life. But is that really what we want our orientation of our life to be about? And so to spend some time reflecting on our intention. And if what we're doing is entering the Buddhist path, what is the intention that can align ourselves with that path? And the Buddha gave three primary definitions of this intention. And embarrassingly enough, I only remember tonight two. But one of them is the intention to love, the intention to metta, loving kindness. The intention to love, to bring kindness or friendliness to our world, is one of the primary expressions of this right intention. It's not easy to love, and different people have different abilities to do it and different dispositions towards it. But to cultivate love and to, you know, to develop it is one of the intentions. The other intention is the intention to let go, to simplify life and to let go of things, to learn how to let go. And it certainly can mean classically to let go of things, but the things aren't the problem. The problem is the way we relate to things. And so the training in letting go is the training to, the intention to let go is the intention not to cling to things and hold on to things. Letting go of that clinging, that holding. So, which can be hard to do at times. I don't know if it makes sense to tell you a story from today, but I'll let it go. So I think of the second step of the Eightfold Path having to do with intention being to take seriously your intention. Our intentions are some of the most beautiful parts of our lives and some of the most consequential aspects of our lives. In many ways, Buddhism is a religion of intention. Intention is so important in Buddhism that getting to know our intention and studying it. Many people go through their lives never really looking seriously at their intentions or the deepest intention of their heart. Buddhism suggests you spend time, serious time, reflecting deep down into your heart and what is the intention that you want to live your life with. So that's the first two. The next three parts of the Eightfold Path all have to do with ethics. And ethics has a lot to do with how you live your life in relationship to other people. And I love this because the spiritual life is not meant to be done in isolation. It's not only something self-centered and self-serving, but it's something we do in the field of our connectedness to other people. So the third step of the Eightfold Path is right speech. Being careful with our speech. Speech is very consequential. As it's sometimes said, you can spend years cultivating a really good friend, and you can ruin that friendship in just one sentence. That's how powerful speech is. But more deeply for me, our speech is a doorway into our intentions. If you pay attention for a while to why you say certain things that you say, you're probably opened up to a whole world of what it is that makes you tick. What are your values you have? What is your assumptions about your relationship to other people? The things that you want out of life and expect out of life are often expressed through how we speak. And so to cultivate mindfulness and follow the path is to turn the attention around to really study how we speak and to cultivate right speech. Cultivate speech which is helpful not only for others but also for yourself. If you want to follow a path, it turns out that being careful with your speech is one of the ways of making progress on that path. It's that important. And some people, you know, choose their clothes more carefully than they choose what they say. So, you know, a lot of people wouldn't do too much harm to pay a little bit more attention to their speech. To speak kindly. To speak in a way that speaks the truth. To speak in a way that helps. Oh, I read this last week in a sutta. To speak in such a way that is conducive to the concentration for others, that's conducive to concentration, that's conducive to meditative absorption, it's conducive to meditative, entering into a meditative state. It's beautiful. The next part of the Eightfold Path is right action. And right action is just, you know, right behavior. It's usually defined by the five precepts. So it's to avoid things like killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, and intoxicating the mind. And as I say often, the Buddhist path is a path of developing sensitivity, becoming more sensitive, letting ourselves become a much more sensitive instrument that we can tune in to the world around us and to ourselves and what's really going on to the best of our ability. And to do unethical things is to do things in an insensitive manner. The assumption being that in order to hurt someone intentionally, there has to be some insensitivity to that person as a human being. And so to develop sensitivity, if you're trying to develop sensitivity and you do insensitive things, they don't work together. One of the things that helps in developing the path then is cultivating right action, action which defined as not breaking the precepts. I found in my own life that my action also, see, speech and action are much more gross than the activity of the mind. And meditation, in a sense, mindfulness, works in a sense with the mind. And it's kind of like the advanced practice. And it's a lot easier to begin with a coarser activity. And so speech and action are coarser than activities of the mind. So learning to pay attention there and cultivate mindfulness and develop mindfulness in these areas creates a foundation, helpful foundation, for then developing mindfulness for the more subtle aspects of our life. The next part of the Eightfold Path is right livelihood. So I'll recap what we've done so far. There's right view, right intention, right speech, right action, and now it's right livelihood. And right livelihood is just where you get your livelihood from, what supports your life. It doesn't necessarily mean what you do for work and make money, but where your livelihood. The Buddha, I was a little bit surprised when I saw this, when I was introduced to Buddhism, that, that had any bearing at all on the path. But this is such an important element of our life. We spend so many hours of our life, so many hours of the day, majority of our time for many of us, engaged in livelihood. And so is our livelihood conducive and supportive and in harmony with a spiritual path? If it's not, then, it's not going to, if it's not in harmony, then it's going to be hard to make any progress along that path. Like the now almost mythical story that I tell so often of the lawyer who came and said, I'm very interested in practicing meditation and following the Buddhist path. But in my law firm, I'm expected to lie. Now, how can I do both? And the way he asked it was he was really expecting us to tell him. And we had to tell him, the unfortunate news that you can't do both, that the two just don't jibe. So the Buddha then listed, so I take this right livelihood to be another opportunity to look at our intentions and to look at how our actions affect the world around us. Is how, we spend the majority of our working time, is it a way that is in harmony with not causing harm in the world, maybe creating benefit to the world around us? Then we have sitting here in the hall today three of my son's preschool teachers who are my heroes. And I feel like they're the greatest definition of right livelihood. It's like one of the most greatest things around. And they had my son's graduation today. And I just, I didn't express it so well, but I was really moved. It's just like these people you entrust your two-year-old to, right? And they take this two-year-old in and they make this two-year-old kind of into a person. And then today one of them joked that there was a money-back guarantee. So we'll see. So right livelihood. And then... So these first five then become the foundation for the last three, and I think of it as a pyramid or a triangle, with the first five being the base of the pyramid, and now we're getting up to the top of the pyramid, and they create the strong, stable foundation. If you turn the pyramid upside down, so it's standing on its head, it's going to be quite wobbly. Turns out that the last pinnacle of the very top of the pyramid is meditation, concentration, and mindfulness. And many people enter the Buddhist path through meditation practice. And sooner or later, you'll learn that that's a very wobbly place to begin, unless you kind of spread out the foundation. And that's what the first five elements are about. So the last three are right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Right effort means being willing to make the effort, be interested in making the effort, not just being a person who reads the menu in the restaurant, but actually tastes the food, not someone who just reads maps, but actually sets themselves on the path. But it also means the definition of right effort is to start, a classic definition involves beginning to pay attention to the quality of your mind. What's the quality of your mind like? Is the quality of the mind helpful, wholesome, skillful, or is the quality of your mind and your actions unhelpful, unwholesome, unskillful? So this is much more subtle now than simply paying attention to your right action or right speech, but it's looking behind those things at the quality of the mind that does it, the quality of the heart. And being interested, and then beginning to align that heart or that mind with those, that quality of mind, that aspect of the mind, that direction of the mind that is skillful and helpful and, for a spiritual life. So, you know, you can watch your thoughts, you can watch your intentions, you can watch your feelings that arise, and you can look at them and say, "What is this really helpful or not?" And we don't want to deny or repress anything in unhealthy ways, which I think a lot of us know about. But often it can be very easy to let go of a certain train of thought, a certain motivation, a certain quality of mind that's not helpful, and try to, you know, pick up one that's helpful. Or if you have one that's helpful, to support it and nourish it and appreciate it. Sometimes it can be easy, and sometimes it's very hard to do this. And so then we have a meditation practice, a mindfulness practice. We have the Eightfold Path, the whole package, to help us along the way. It's a gradual path. And then you're not expected to do it automatically, just fresh off, you know, your first step on the path. But as you walk along the path, slowly, slowly, you'll find your way. One of the things you'll start learning is how to pay attention to the quality of your mind. Then there's right concentration and right mindfulness. And this involves the meditation practice. And this is, you know, the pinnacle of the pyramid and the most subtle aspect of Buddhist spirituality. Because now we're looking at the subtlety of the movements of the heart, the movements of the mind. We're looking at we're cultivating the mind's ability to bring presence to our experience. The mind's ability to be present, to see and notice in a non-reactive way what's happening in the present moment. The untrained mind is often very reactive, having preferences, likes and dislikes, for and against things, wanting, not wanting. And to cultivate the phenomenal jewel, the phenomenal treasure of unreactive awareness. All of us have the ability to be present in this luminous way that is not for or against anything, but just simply holds the experience as it is. And that's a training in mindfulness. The concentration practice is a training that supports the mindfulness so that luminous awareness can be held very, very steady. It's like a flame. The flame mindfulness is like the flame. But if there's a lot of wind, the flame blows around a lot and flickers and maybe blows out. And the concentration is what helps make that flame be unwavering, so it doesn't blow out and doesn't flicker. And those two together, to have very capacity for great concentration and great mindfulness, then helps the mind free it, and the heart free itself of the shackles, free itself from what restricts it, what gets in the way of the heart shining, of the heart being free, being loving, being compassionate in a world that needs so much compassion. But the goal is not to be loving, the goal is not to be compassionate. It's part of the path to do those things. They're very important. But the goal is to cultivate this open-heartedness, this equanimity and peace of the heart, to its ultimate capacity to do that. And that's where the Four Noble Truths, that perspective, becomes very important, as I said earlier. We want to keep looking, keep refining, keep ferreting out the subtlest attachments that the mind's still holding on to. So eventually the consciousness can release itself. And it's one of the miraculous things, because it's almost as if consciousness itself is a kind of an attachment. And consciousness releases itself. But when consciousness is released, who's there to experience what's there? It's kind of like, you know, if you try to touch your elbow. The ultimate liberation in Buddhism is this release of consciousness, which it's kind of like it can't be talked about because it's not an object of consciousness, because there's no consciousness there to experience it. However, Buddhism doesn't want to say there's no consciousness. It kind of wants to say it's consciousness without an object. But what's that? So, very simply, it's freedom or liberation, the experience of the sure heart's release, the release of the heart. It's the heart's greatest wish to be released of anything that holds it down. So the Eightfold Path is that path that we can take that leads eventually to that release of the heart. You know, when Buddhists, when express their devotion and their deep intention to follow the path, they take what's called refuge. Often, colloquially in English, we say taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But the literal Pali is not, it doesn't mean to take, which seems like very American. I'm going to take it. It literally means I go for refuge to the Buddha. I go. Actually, the word is walk in Pali. I walk for refuge. So it's something you bring. Walking means you bring your whole being into that activity. So the Eightfold Path, the teaching of the Eightfold Path, is a reminder of the possibility, the potential we have of bringing an integrated being, or integrating our full being as part of the path. And you might sit and think about this next time you sit down to meditate. Is there some way, just in that meditation session, that you can integrate and include your whole being as something engaged in the practice of meditation? Not just something of the mind, not just something of the heart, but something of your body, something of your heart, something of your mind, something of the unconditioned, something of freedom. Bring everything you have into that practice. If you do that, you'll find yourself in the present moment. You won't have to struggle to be in the present. You'll find yourself there if you bring everything you are into that moment of practice. So, thank you. This is actually, I think, the first time I've ever done a talk on the Eightfold Path here for our group. In all these 12 years I've been teaching us, I was intimidated by the list of 8 things to go through. So now I've done it. So thank you all very much. And may whatever path is your path, open freely and broadly, becomes an easy walk. Thank you.